Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Young people can change the world, especially when they work with experienced leaders. And that's the philosophy behind the Global Good Fund, which has been around since 2011 and is the brainchild of my guest today. Its mission is to accelerate development of high-potential young leaders who, through entrepreneurship, tackle the world's greatest social issues. Carrie Rich was one of those high-potential young leaders. At 15, she co-founded Teens for Technology, a nonprofit whose goal was to bring computer literacy to young people living on the island nation of Jamaica. Within 3 years, it delivered more than 100,000 computers. Today, the organization is self-sustaining, and it's run by locals. While an adjunct at Georgetown, where Carrie got a master's in health systems administration, she developed a healthcare sustainability curriculum, the first of its kind. The syllabus eventually became a book, Sustainability for Healthcare Management, a Leadership Imperative. Carrie also co-developed business plans, drummed up dollars, approached and hired CEOs to run My Primary Care Doctor, and Blue to Green LLC. That company employs people with special needs to produce environmentally friendly accessories made of recycled blue wrap. She is also the scholarship chair of the National Capital Healthcare Executives and former board chair of Everybody Eats DC, a nonprofit restaurant. Carrie, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how does a 15-year-old launch a nonprofit?
Well, actually, you know, I came in as one of, I think it was the third person engaged in Teens for Technology. And the first person was my friend Anders Jones. When he was 13, he went on a business trip with his father, who was doing work in Jamaica. And he sat in the back of a taxi cab. And he and the taxi cab driver got talking. And the taxi cab driver said, you know, my son goes to school. He's your age. And he goes to school with 800 children and one computer.
What year was that?
Let's see, it must have been 12 years ago.
Okay.
They all shared one computer, 800 children.
Good Lord.
And Andrew scratched his head and he said, well, I go to school with 80 students and 100 computers. And that difference didn't seem right to Anders. So he said to the taxi cab driver, you know, I have, his name was Carl. He said, Carl, you know, I have another computer in my basement. I wonder if I could bring it to the school where your sons go, if it would make a difference. And Carl said, you know, Anders, that's nice, but 800 students and two computers really doesn't make much of a difference.
Right.
And that's where the seed of Teens for Technology was created.
So he came home from this trip to Jamaica and he said, I got to do something.
Exactly.
And he enlisted his good friend, Carrie Rich.
That's right. And we had a mutual friend and the three of us and you know, it grew. So they were actually teenagers helping other teenagers through computer literacy. And apparently 19 attempts had been made prior to Teens for Technology, all by adults helping kids. And the reality was when teens help teens, and there was a model in place so that it wasn't just a handout, it was actually a hand up in the community helping itself and sustaining itself and teaching the next community and the next education center how they could embrace technology to future the education of young people. That's really how Teens for Technology came to be.
Here you are, three teenagers. Did you know what you were doing? How long did it take you to actually get this thing off the ground?
Well, I joined several months in, and we were just completing our first school. And I thought to myself, gee, if we could do one school, I wonder if we could put computers in a trash dump where people lived. And it's where the entire community hauled its trash.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this amazing community center. And I figured, you know, if we could, it's called Riverton. You know, and my thought was if we could computerize a community within a trash dump, you could really bring literacy anywhere. And sure enough, once that community got off the ground and the other schools got off the ground, it became sort of this multiplier effect where the next community was waiting, asking, what do we need to do in order to bring computer literacy there? And really, it was driven by the community. So the teenagers would match the funds raised by the community, and the Gates Foundation would donate computers that were refurbished after being used for 1 year.
That's where I was going. From whom did you get your computers?
Well, in the beginning, we started asking our parents, you know, do you have any colleagues who might have computers that they want to get rid of. But mm-hmm. the reality was it wasn't, there was no quality control. We'd get all kinds of computers, very generous people. But in terms of repairing them and making sure that everyone had the same standards and could be used by the students effectively in Jamaica, that wasn't a good plan. And so we really revised the strategy and accepted standard computers that were issued through, you know, Bill Gates effectively, and it was refurbished in a warehouse in Texas. They were shipped by Jamaican Airlines, and they did it, you know, out of the goodness and also for PR opportunities, which we of course loved. We started shipping them overseas and then flying the team, and eventually said, you know, it's crazy to have 14-year-olds flying back and forth. And
Carrie? I mean, really?
this is exactly how it happened. And, you know, the thing was adults got involved. We weren't doing it alone. Our parents were incredibly supportive. And business leaders in Jamaica got involved. You know, the head of the local newspaper. We would go to the Minister of Education, the ambassador's home, and meet with other teenagers. And eventually it got to the point where we were hiring local staff. You know, these teenagers helping to choose.
Yeah, you three pipsqueaks were doing this?
Well, it grew. You know, we were 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 in college. I stayed involved and, and you know, other people got engaged. So a DC chapter opened and we would mentor the students in high school who were going once we were in college. So that's how it grew. It sort of snowballed. And I think if you'd asked us, you know, what was the business plan at the time, I'm hoping one of our parents had an idea, because we were really putting one foot in front of the other with a grand vision that if we could empower our peers, other teenagers in Jamaica and eventually in other countries, what a gift to society that would be through education and computer literacy.
Oh, absolutely. And where was this? In D.C.? Is that where you all started?
Well, we all grew up outside of Boston.
Aha.
And eventually another chapter opened in D.C. And in fact, again, today, we're all still in touch. I just went to dinner with the Anders, the founder, and his mother is engaged in the Global Good Fund, and a board member stemmed out of someone I met in Jamaica doing Teens for Technology. And, you know, we all went on to pursue our own ambitions, but Teens for Technology is really what gave us the platform to figure out how to organize, how to be a catalyst for positive change, how to speak in front of large communities and really engage our peers.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Carrie Ridge, who is the founder of the Global Good Fund. So here you are, you're a teenager, you have a commitment to help others. Then you go on to college. This just carried along with you. You knew that this was something that you were going to do with your life?
Well, you know, frankly, it felt like the right thing to do, and I'm not sure it was so much of a strategic plan. But it was the right thing to do. And there was momentum that was building that, frankly, didn't need us. You know, at one point, we were going 5 times a year to Jamaica. And, you know, I would go and one time, you know, I would go by myself and meet the other teenagers along the way. And some people, there would be chaperones, obviously. But, you know, it was largely driven by the teenagers with support of our loved ones. As we moved on to college, younger teens took on the reins and they became the leaders. And those teenagers included Jamaicans who, you know, are leading the organization today. And again, you know, we communicate, you know, at least several times a month with the folks in Jamaica today, both the ones who are originally engaged and those who are leading today.
Teens for Technology started you off that way, then college, and then you developed this healthcare sensibility systems administration. And my primary care doctor and Blue to Green LLC, I'm not trying to jumble them all together, but it was all just a natural progression for you to do this?
Well, you know, I think I was frustrated. In each of these situations, I was frustrated. I was frustrated that my friend had so many computers to choose from, and my peers in Jamaica basically had none. And I was frustrated that society was spending $250 billion at the time in the US alone on healthcare facilities and building them with carcinogens known to cause cancer for a healthcare facility. And I was frustrated that we were putting blue wrap, which is the materials that are used to wrap surgical tools, I was frustrated that we were putting that blue wrap material into the ground instead of recycling it. And I was frustrated. You know, I didn't know what to do about it. So I just started putting one foot in front of the other and really started asking questions. You know, why are we putting blue wrap into the ground? Why are we building hospitals with known cancer carcinogens? And that's really what led was what am I going to do about being frustrated about these things? And I'm not just going to sit there.
And so what'd you do?
For the sustainability curriculum, I had been pursuing training with the idea that at some point in my future, maybe 15, 20 years from the time, I would perhaps teach at a community college. That was my dream, as some sort of hobby, you know, a way to give back. And at the time that I was in graduate school, you know, to pay for tuition, I was working at a healthcare architecture firm, which again ties back to Jamaica and Teens for Technology. I had had a conversation with one of my peers' fathers when we were in Jamaica. And he asked me, Carrie, what part of the bookstore do you go into when you enter a bookshop? And I said, well, that's easy, the architecture section. I take a big stack of books and I go sit down in the comfy chair and look at all the pictures. And he said, oh, you must love architecture, then you must want to be an architect. And I said, no, in fact, I love health administration. I love healthcare and making the world more well, keeping us healthy. And he said, well, in fact, you know, my sister-in-law runs an architecture firm that designs healthcare facilities. And that was my first foray into healthcare architecture. Of course, it stemmed from Teams for Technology and a conversation we had in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Well, fast forward to college, and I found myself working at my second architecture firm that designs healthcare facilities called Perkins and Will. And that was this incredible opportunity to be the liaison between designers, which is a very creative space, one that, you know, I had no idea how designers were trained or how they thought or how critique was integrated in an iterative process, and marry that with the business world that health effectively operates in. And I was frustrated because I was going through school learning how to be a health administrator, learning how to do the business side of hospitals, and we were spending money and strategizing on how to build facilities, yet none of the operational thinking for running a sustainable healthcare facility was being taught in school.
And so that's what prompted you to take action.
That's right. So I was writing all my school papers at the time on healthcare sustainability. And finally, the chair of the department came to me and she said, Carrie, in addition to writing papers about this topic, why don't you write a curriculum about healthcare sustainability? And I thought, well, gee, this is great. And I just figured that, you know, as a graduate student, you sort of do your work and turn it over and someone else takes it from there. So I just figured that was the same situation here. But, you know, a week later, the reality was I'd been working on the curriculum anyway as part of my training for teaching perhaps one day in a community college. And so a week later, I brought in the syllabus that I'd been working on along with two sports bags. And in the sports bags, I'd been collecting articles, journals, online reading materials about healthcare sustainability, and found that there was really no book on the topic. And so the chair of the department turned to me and, you know, I dropped both gym bags in front of her with all the reading materials in it. And she said, you know, how would you feel about teaching this course, Carrie? And I was 21 at the time and really hadn't dreamed of such an opportunity, but it became a really transformational moment in my life to not only be creative in developing a curriculum, but then actually getting to implement it.
So you're on this course from one project to another, and then comes the Global Good Fund in 2011. How did that get started? Why did that get started?
Well, it goes back to the sustainability curriculum, actually.
Everything's connected, huh?
It is. What happened was I'd been interning at a Nova Health system in Northern Virginia. And the reason I was doing that is because it was part of my degree program that we did an internship in a healthcare organization. And I was willing to do anything. I just wanted to get to network and learn. And so one day I had the opportunity to take attendance, which was the best task I could have been asked to do because it meant I got to introduce myself and meet face to face with all of the administrators of the health system. And one such administrator was the CEO of the health system, Knox Singleton. He'd been CEO of Inova longer than I'd been alive and grown the organization from one hospital to a multi-billion dollar networked health and wellness entity. And this seemed to me like a wonderful person to stay in touch with. And so I approached Knox and asked him if we could have a conversation, wondering, you know, he gets asked to have a conversation multiple times a day. Why would he bother having a conversation with me, an intern? So we had started having a conversation about what it means to live a life and build a legacy, live a life of purpose and build a legacy. And I, you know, I dressed in a very formal business suit and pulled my hair back in a tight bun. And at the end of the conversation, I thought, how could I make a way for Knox and I to engage with each other for years to come so I can learn from him? And at the end of the conversation, I said, Knox, would you be willing to write a book with me?
You got a lot of balls, Carrie, huh?
He looked at me and he said, well, sure. What are we going to write a book about? And I just lost it. I said, oh, this is so cool. You know, I lost all of my composure. I said, this is so cool. I said, well, how's healthcare sustainability? I've been working on this curriculum and teaching at the curriculum at Georgetown. And I think it could be the first of its kind in the world and really garner interest from a global audience. And through that process, Knox and I, over a year, along with another colleague named Seema Wadhwa, who's the director of the Healthier Hospitals Initiative, she and Knox and I engaged in a year-long process in writing a book about healthcare sustainability. And over that period of time, Knox would really pontificate, and we would come in and structure his thinking. And he would pontificate, and we would figure out how to communicate the vision for the future of health sustainability. And one day he called up on the phone, which I hadn't expected, and he said, hello, Carrie, this is Knox Singleton calling from Inova Health System. And I said, this is a prank caller. I'm going to hang up. And so he called back, and that began what turned into a new job for me. So I transitioned from working at the architectural firm and teaching to health administration, which had been my passion since the time I was going to Jamaica through Teens for Technology. And I transitioned to be the director of vision translation at Inova, which meant coming up with the future vision of health for Inova in Northern Virginia and translating what that meant. And through that process, I had a conversation with my boss one day, with Knox. And I said, you know, Knox, it's amazing what could be achieved with relatively small amounts of money. And he said, you know, Carrie, that's nice, but could you go back to doing your work? And I sort of hung my head and went back to my business. And 2 months later, it was my 26th birthday, and Knox handed me a card, and I opened the card, and there was a check for $100 and a note that read, Carrie, I was going to take you and your colleagues out to lunch for your birthday. Instead, here's the money I would have spent. Now you can live out your admonition that a small amount of money can go a long way.
Huh. So he gave you a challenge, didn't he?
He did. So I wrote a letter to 6 organizations that I'd volunteered with in the past, including Teens for Technology, a local organization in Anacostia, D.C., a group in Haiti, Tanzania, and others. And I explained that my boss gave me some lunch money, and I'd like to convert that $100 into $1,000 for each of you. What could you do with $1,000? And their answers blew me away. In the Seed School in Anacostia, D.C., literacy rates could dramatically improve within a classroom. In Haiti, 10 families could sustain themselves on community agriculture. In Tanzania, 25 women could go through secondary school. This just blew my mind. $1,000, and that's not a ton of money.
It's not at all.
So I wrote a letter through email to my family and friends, which I'd never directly asked family and friends for money like this before. I'd always, you know, in fundraising for Teens for Technology or businesses, I'd gone through organizations or companies or people I didn't know. So I was, first of all, convinced no one would read my email or respond. I didn't think they would. And secondly, it was 4 days before Christmas by the time I got out to sending this email. And I figured, you know, everyone would be distracted. So I wrote an email documenting that my boss gave me some lunch money, and here are the 6 organizations I'd like to support with your help. If we each gave a little bit, it would add up to a whole lot. Let's see what we can do. And I didn't know what to call the email. You know, you have to put in a subject heading. So I called it the Global Good Fund. And I figured, you know, no one's going to read this email, so I might as well add as many people in the to section as possible. So I typed the letter A. And you know how when you type a letter in your email account, whoever's email address starts with that letter.
Right, appears. Yeah. Right.
So I hit enter, and I added whoever's email, everyone's email that started with the letter A.
And you went down the alphabet?
And a few hours later, there were a few hundred emails, and I hit the send button. And my friends were very generous. You know, we were 26 at the time, and they're sending in $30, $50, $100. And 2 weeks later, it added up to $6,052, $1,000 each for six organizations, which was the goal. And I figured, you know, all done. I sort of clapped my hands and went to distribute the funding, one-time deal. And then I got an email from an address I didn't recognize. And I searched back in my account and found that this was an individual whose email address had popped up when I added the letter. And I'd met this person at a conference a year earlier, had no idea he had any money. And I'd exchanged business cards with him after sitting at lunch, and I'd followed up and said, "Nice to meet you." And that was it for a whole year. And he responded to my email titled The Global Good Fund. And the first sentence said, "I'd like to stay anonymous," which we've respected to this day. And the second sentence said, "I'd like to donate $1 million to the Global Good Fund."
Are you kidding me?
"Where should I send the check?" And I'm thinking, he's pranking me. This has to be a joke. This can't be real. So I responded that if this isn't a prank, meet me at this very public location on this date and time. It has lots of surveillance cameras, and I'm not going to wait past 10 minutes, you know, for you to show up.
And was this in 2011?
That's right.
Okay. This sounds like something from an old television show. Like, what was that show, The Millionaire? I can't remember.
Right.
It predates you, but yeah.
I couldn't imagine. So early January, he in fact shows up.
The masked man shows up.
With a bank certified check for $1 million made out to the Global Good Fund, which of course the organization, the Global Good Fund, didn't exist. It was the subject heading of an email.
Oh, God.
And he asked me, he looked at me and he said, "What will you do with the money?" And I said, "Honestly, I didn't prepare as much as I should have. I didn't think you would come. But the truth is, the part of my life that's been so meaningful is having people pull me up and coach me and mentor me. If we could identify high potential young leaders throughout the world who are dedicating their lives to social impact through entrepreneurship and match them with people who have experience, what a gift to society that would be if we could accelerate the development of the young people and the enterprises they support."
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Carrie Ridge, who is the founder of the Global Good Fund, and she's been explaining how this fund got off the ground. So this masked millionaire, did he ever tell you who he was? I mean, he obviously signed the check, and he didn't sign it John Doe, did he?
No. In fact, he was the same person he was the person who showed up at the conference a year earlier, and, you know, he was an acquaintance. Yeah, so he stayed engaged, but he stayed anonymous.
I understand.
Well.
And so this now propels you to a whole other level. You've got all this money and you got to start an organization here, don't you?
I had no idea what to do.
Oh, stop saying that. Apparently you always did.
Having $1 million, but you know, that's a big responsibility to have someone hand you a check. And I didn't know what to do because he made the check out to an organization that didn't exist.
Okay. So you become a 501c3 right away, right?
Right. Well, it takes a while. So I just didn't know how to figure it out. So I, of course, went back to my boss, Knox, who gave me the initial lunch money. And I was shaking, standing there shaking with the check. And I flung
over
the
door. Knox, boy, could I take you for a meal.
And I slammed the check down on the table. I said, "Look what you've done. You gave me the lunch money and this nearly a stranger gave $1 million to the Global Good Fund. I have no idea what to do. Will you help me?" And he said, "Well, tell me the vision." And I said, "The vision is that we'd identify young leaders throughout the world who are high potential and accelerate their development so that they could apply themselves to social impact through entrepreneurship." And he smiled and said, "Well, I'd like to help you with this idea under two conditions." And he said, "The first condition is that at work at Inova, you report to me. At the Global Good Fund, I'd like to report to you."
Oh, wow.
He was empowering me the whole time through. He said, "The second condition is I'd like to match the initial gift." So this is 2 weeks later with two people, $2 million and a vision. And that's how the Global Good Fund was.
Because I was starting to think that Knox and $100 sound a little on the cheap side. You know what I mean? I mean, where's he, you know, $100. I mean, come on. So take us to today. This amazing organization is started. And what does it do today?
We've supported 19 entrepreneurs in 11 countries to date. Over 50% are women, 50% are for-profits with a social mission, meaning the reason they were created is to fulfill a social cause, and the other 50% are nonprofit entities with revenue-generating streams. 50% of our activity is within the U.S. We believe that it's important to invest both locally and globally. And they're in different parts of the world, including Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And we're about to launch our commercial product. So this is our first attempt at creating our own revenue stream to support and reinvest in the Global Good Fund and the entrepreneurs we really have the privilege to support longer term. The Global Good Fund was really grew by putting one foot in front of the other, the same way Teens for Technology grew or creating a sustainability curriculum grew or any company grows. And the reality is Knox reached out to his peers, the presidents of universities, the CEOs of banks.
Sure, you have a track record.
You do. And that's something I didn't have. So one of the things that I learned to do was be okay with leveraging other people's credibility, because I really didn't have the experience to be credible at that point. I am still developing my track record.
And yeah, but you have a lot of chutzpah.
That's what my mother tells me. So I really reached out to my peers, and there were amazing, incredibly inspiring people all over the world who, if they had the visibility, had the platform, had the people caring and saying, I believe in you, and had the financial support to grow themselves, grow their leadership development as a vehicle for enterprise growth, that became the focus of the Global Good Fund. And that's the same as it is today. We have our flagship fellowship program. We'll be investing in 10 more entrepreneurs in January 2015. And we're launching our first attempt at commercial products.
And what does that mean?
Basically, commercialized components of the fellowship program. So we're able to sell at a price-sensitive point that anyone in the world can afford. Leadership development assessment tools, leadership coaching for social entrepreneurs, and leadership development planning specifically tailored for social entrepreneurs.
How do you pick your fellows?
So we rely heavily on field partners who are locally accessing high potential young leaders and can refer people who have strong enterprises where we can do due diligence on the leadership development process. We make co-investments with impact investors and venture capitalists, and we also have an online open enrollment process. So that basically gives us an opportunity for anyone in the world with internet access to be able to apply. And we have a six-month due diligence process that walks us through everything from leadership development to enterprise growth and social impact. Today, we're actually narrowing the top 150 semifinalists to the top 30 finalists down to the top 10 Global Good Fund fellows.
So there are 10 finalists every year?
Well, we've grown. So we are on our fourth cohort. The first year there were 5. The second year there were 6. We did 8 the second year as well. So we had 2 cohorts the second year. Now we're on our fourth, and so it'll be 10. So it went 5, 6, 8, 10 fellows this year.
And do you accept donations from regular folk?
We certainly do. Globalgoodfund.org is our website, and I'd be delighted to receive donations directly. You can email me at carrie@globalgoodfund.org.
Carrie, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you this last question. Do you look back over these last 5, 6 years, and are you just amazed at what you gave birth to?
Well, when you put it all together, it's exciting, but the truth is day to day, it doesn't necessarily look like the big picture. And so I try to take a step back, and really this opportunity gives me the opportunity to appreciate what the big picture looks like. And I'm proud of how I'm spending my time and proud of the team that I get to support and be part of.
I think you're a little on the self-deprecating side. I'm so impressed with your commitment and your drive and your passion. And if the world had a lot more Carrie Riches, boy, would we be a lot richer for it. I can't thank you enough for taking time to have a conversation with me. I think you're amazingly inspiring, and I wish you nothing but continued success. It has been a real pleasure to get to know you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and your support, Sandy.
Anytime. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.